I've cared about empathy for longer than I even knew what that word meant, right? So it turns out that my parents come from really different cultures, and they had a long and difficult divorce while I was a kid. I'm their only child, and so I was sort of the bridge between their worlds and kind of spent a lot of my childhood shuffling back and forth between their houses. But sometimes it felt like I was sort of between different parallel universes. You know, when I was with my mom, I had to figure out what she cared about and learn to care about it myself. But when I got to my dad's house, those same rules would stop working.
Can you think of an example of what would change when you would go to your dad's house?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So my dad is from Pakistan, and he often told me that where he was from, the kid who got the highest score on a test would go to college, but the kid who got the second highest score would end up on the streets. So he was extremely, he was like very, very sort of achievement driven as a result maybe of that. And he wanted that for me too. So he would constantly talk about, you know, how smart I was and how smart I needed to be and what he wanted me to do for work and, you know, what type of physician he wanted me to be. So he really wanted me to be that type of person, driven.
Like, what type of physician? It wasn't a question that you would be a physician. It was just like, what type of physician?
Oh, yeah. No, exactly. I mean, even when I got my PhD or was working towards my PhD, he said, you know, are you sure that you don't want to switch over to an MD, you know, be a real doctor. And my mom is like this very relational creature, you know, she cares about family above everything else. And so it sort of was like they wanted me to be different people and care about different things. And it was really hard work, you know, it's really hard emotional labor. And I kind of feel like for a while, all three of us thought that I'd have to choose one of my parents and give up on the other one. But I kind of knew that I needed to keep on trying. I couldn't lose both of them. We couldn't lose our family. And so I did keep on trying, and it got easier over time. And, you know, I sort of learned, I guess one of the big skills that I learned was to tune myself to their different frequencies and understand that even two people who really fundamentally disagree with each other can nonetheless be coming from fundamentally similar human places, right? Their histories, the pain that they've endured, the hopes that they have. And so I guess, you know, one way.
And you were thinking about this at age what?
Well, eight. I mean, I don't think that I was using the same language that I am now. But, you know, just that, God, these are two really good people. You know, and the fact that they don't understand or like each other doesn't mean that I can't understand both of them. You know, there's room in our minds and in our hearts for more than one way of viewing the world, which, you know, I mean, I guess to me now is what empathy really means.
Mm. And so fast forward, at what point did you, you know, pinpoint this as an area you'd want to study?
Well, I knew that I was interested in empathy as a person. As a scientist and sort of student, I was most interested in the brain. I was just fascinated by the idea that a 3-pound bag of Jell-O between our ears could sort of produce all of our experiences and all of our self. And so in college, I wanted to, or asked one of my professors, you know, could you study empathy in the brain? And he immediately said, no, that's a silly idea. You can only scan one person's brain at a time, but empathy requires two people. So no. And so I listened to him. I shouldn't have. And then once I got out of college and was working in a research lab, a paper came out. This was 2004. And it was this paper in which they had gotten romantic couples and brought them into the lab. And they had put one of them in an MRI scanner. And then the other one was sitting just outside. And they were holding hands. And the person in the scanner, from where they were lying, they could see both people's hands, their own and their romantic partner's. And then the scientists proceeded to give each of them electric shocks over and over again, painful electric shocks. And what they found was that people activated the same parts of their brain when they were receiving shocks and when they were looking at their partner receiving shocks. It was as though they felt the pain of a person who they loved at a physical, physiological level. And that was such a powerful demonstration to me, and it really married the two things that I cared most about, you know, the brain and our ability to connect with one another. So I was hooked. I mean, from then on, I knew that's what I was going to study.
And it made sense to you.
Oh, yeah. Does it make sense to you?
It absolutely does. I mean, and there's so many things that are just, I don't know, just like natural and make sense, but you can't prove it. So thank you for doing the science part and proving it for us, I suppose. And so where did you begin? How would you start? What was the question that you were trying to answer?
How do we understand each other? And why are we so good at it? Why are we sometimes so bad at it? And can we get better at it? Those were the questions that I started with. I mean, so I developed this paradigm, this sort of type of experiment when I got to graduate school that was called an empathic accuracy paradigm. So what this is, you know, one group of people, we videotape them while they talk about the most emotionally intense events of their life that they're willing to share. Obviously, nothing that's super private. Right. And so have you ever seen like MTV's The Real World? Am I dating myself as like ancient?
I'm dating myself too when I say, yeah, I remember The Real World.
Oh, yeah. So there were these things called confessionals, right? Where you'd see some interaction between people. They were fighting or, you know, making out or something. Mm-hmm. And then it would cut to one person looking right in the camera and say, you know how that made me feel? Or I was struggling with this, right? So that's basically what we have. We have this set of videos where people are talking right at the camera to you as you watch them about some important moment in their life. Mm-hmm. Right after we videotaped them, we played these people back the videos of themselves talking about their experiences, and we gave them this kind of rating knob. You know, like the type of knob that you might see people using to rate what they think about a presidential candidate during a debate, you know, it sort of goes up and down over time. And we said, please rate how you felt while you were talking, from really positive to really negative. And so we get these kind of landscapes, these contours of people's emotional lives. And then afterwards, we took those videos and played them to a different group of people. Mm-hmm. And those people use the same rating knob to guess what they think the other person feels from moment to moment. So if you see where I'm going with this, you can compare the two people's ratings over time and basically say, am I grasping the moments where you feel joy or suffering or ambivalence, right? Basically, am I grasping the way that your emotions are moving over time? And that was our measure of empathic accuracy, right? Our ability to get each other.
Okay, so let's take this step by step. Let's say I did feel or get what you're feeling. Did you measure or did you ask people then what do you do with that?
Oh, absolutely. And so it turns out that people who are more empathically accurate, and this is not just my work, this is other people's as well, but people who are more empathically accurate, for instance, are better able to manage their close relationships, right? They know if they're fighting with their partner in some marital spat, they know when to pull back. They know when somebody needs help. They know when to leave somebody alone. I mean, basically, empathic accuracy is one touchstone, one key to successful relationships because it allows us to tune in to what other people need, not just what we imagine they might need.
So you say that empathy is teachable. You know, you look around you in your personal life, in your community circles, maybe in society at large with everything that's going on politically, or I was listening to the news this morning, it was BBC Outlook, and it was the story, one of the many stories of migrants trying to get from Africa to Europe, and this Italian ship saved a number of migrants from the water. And then the Italian authorities just would not let them in. German authorities would not let them in. And they were stranded, like it's a European ship with a European flag, but they would not let them in. And it was this struggle, like of hours and hours and hours back and forth. And, you know, and I knew I was going to talk to you today, and I couldn't help but think, you know, really? You can teach empathy?
I mean, yeah.
It doesn't seem like it.
Well, look, I mean, the idea that people act in enormously cruel and callous ways is not fundamentally in opposition to the idea that empathy is teachable. A lot mm-hmm. of things are teachable. That doesn't mean they're easy, right? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mm-hmm. mean that they're natural, and that doesn't mean that everyone expresses them all the time, right? I mean, I think that one of the things that I've learned over the course of my work and talking to so many people for it is that even people who act with great hatred can learn to be better. I mean, I think that's what fundamentally we have to believe in a way. It's thankful that it's also true, right? That people can come back from that type of behavior and can learn to connect better. But yeah, I mean, there's tons of evidence scientifically that the experience that, you know, I think there's a stereotype, which is that those people who did that, you know, who wouldn't allow these folks into port, right, who basically denied their humanity, that those people are just fundamentally bad. They were born that way and they'll die that way. And then there are other people who are empathic and they were born that way and they'll die that way. But there's lots of evidence that, in fact, our experiences shape us at a deeper level, a more profound level than we often realize. And that can mean that our experiences make us worse people in some cases, and our empathy can atrophy, but it can also grow.
For your book, you interviewed a number of people, and one of them was a neo-Nazi. And he is no longer a neo-Nazi. But I want you to kind of tell us about how you met this person, why you interviewed him for this book, and what's the outcome?
Well, I mean, in part, I did think that if you want to really take seriously the idea that empathy and caring are teachable skills, you should look at the hardest case that you can find. Somebody who was just the opposite of kind and empathic, at least at some point in their life, and see how much someone can change. I met Tony McAleer because, in fact, his organization, which is called Life After Hate, contacted me and some other psychologists. They wanted to learn more about the science of empathy. Mm. And I said, well, okay, I'm happy to talk about that. I want to learn more about you and how you got to where you are. Tony was somebody who was really, you know, had a neglectful family, or at least his father was very neglectful of him when he was growing up in Vancouver. And he ended up just a really angry, alienated kid. I mean, let's be clear, the vast majority of angry, alienated kids do not become neo-Nazis, thankfully. And Tony mm-hmm. takes full responsibility for his choices in life. But, you know, he did become, you know, this horribly racist, anti-Semitic, xenophobic person, and that hatred consumed him and drove his life for, well, up until he was in his mid-20s. Mm. But he was able to reform. He was able to come back from that and now sort of leads this movement to help other people get out of a life of hate that he once inhabited.
So I guess my next question is, you say empathy is teachable. How is it teachable? How do you teach it? What do you do?
Well, the first step to teaching empathy, or to, let's say to learn it, right? Let's imagine that most of your listeners are wanting to learn it themselves. Well, the first step is to realize that you can learn it. It turns out that, I don't know if you've ever, you might have heard of my colleague Carol Dweck at Stanford has this idea of growth versus fixed mindsets. The idea is that our beliefs about ourselves shape the way that we face challenges. So she found, for instance, if you tell students, kids, that their intelligence is fixed, that they can never change how smart they are, they don't work as hard when they face a difficult math problem, for instance, because they're like, well, I'll never be smarter, and I don't want to kind of fail at this because it will show how unsmart I am.
Right.
But if you teach kids that intelligence is instead something that they can grow, they take that same difficult problem and they're like, great, this is like a workout for my brain, right? Basically. Mm. And Carol and I have found that the same is true for empathy, right? So when you convince people or tell them that empathy is a skill, They actually work harder at it, especially in cases where it might be difficult. So, for instance, they spend more time listening to the stories of somebody who's a different race than them. Mm-hmm. And they spend more energy trying to understand the opinions of someone they disagree with politically. So the first step, right, to learning or teaching empathy is establishing that it can be learned and can be taught. Sometimes just thinking that we can't change becomes a barrier to that exact change. Mm.
You have to want to learn empathy, right?
Yeah.
Like that seems like it's a key in this experiment. Intent.
I totally agree. And that's a really important point, right? I mean, we have a lot of skills that we don't use, right? Like most of us can run, but most of us don't run marathons, right?
So, nope.
I certainly don't, right? And so it's not just about the ability to do something. It's about the drive to do it, the desire, the willingness, as you put this really nicely. And so that's one of the things that in my research I look a lot at is like, what are the forces that make people want to empathize? And what are the forces that make them not want to empathize? And how can we sort of change those forces, push them around in ways that make people want to empathize more? I'll give you an example, right? Mm. When people think that the world around them is cruel, they feel like it's pointless to empathize. Why should I care if people around me don't care? And what I found in my research is that indeed, if you convince people or show them examples of people around them being kind and empathic, they're more motivated to be kind and empathic because they want to fit in. But if you show them examples of people being cruel and callous, they also want to fit in, and so they act in more selfish ways. Mm. And we ran an experiment in middle schools where we had middle schoolers write about why they valued empathy. Then we collated all their responses. Why? So that when they came back to school the next day, we could give them a brochure, which was all of their friends and classmates saying why they valued empathy, why they liked to empathize. We weren't making something up. We were pointing these students towards the actual social reality around them, which is that they were surrounded by caring. But we found that that made them actually act in more kind ways even 2 months later.
Oh, wow. And what an age group to test this on. Let me just say I have a middle schooler. And it's really interesting that, you know, it's notoriously an age of meanness, a lot of meanness and, you know, just like bullying and all of this. So
oh, yeah.
that's a good age group to test this on if they can be. If you can make middle schoolers empathize, then you have done a lot. So what do you want the average person who reads your book to get out of this, to gain?
Well, you know, I hope that a reader will be empowered, right? I feel like we're living in a time when a lot of us feel really emotionally disenfranchised. Where there's just this culture of extreme division, intolerance, even open hatred, and of loneliness, isolation, and stress. I mean, basically, like we're more atomized than we ever have been before, and we have fewer opportunities to really connect with each other. And many of those opportunities, like on Twitter, for instance, are not structured in ways that allow for great and productive conversation that often. And I think that it's warping our sense of who we are. You know, we feel as though empathy is on the decline. And it is, by the way. The surveys suggest that we are less empathic than we were even 30 years ago as a culture. And I kind of feel like many people have sort of become hopeless and helpless and feel like, hey, that's just who we are. We're headed down this path to becoming crueler and less connected over time, and it's inevitable. In fact, since I wrote this book, I've heard from hundreds of people who want a more empathic culture but feel that they're alone. Mm. So I want people to realize that they're not alone and that there is something that they can do about it. Right, that we can learn to empathize better, we can learn to connect better. Even if you do that as an individual, you stand to gain because empathy helps people in all sorts of ways.
And what can an individual do in their own home, in their own community? They don't have to go to, like, the Stanford lab that you head, right?
Of course.
What kinds of tools can you give people?
Yeah, I mean, so, again, the first thing is to realize that you can grow. Then, how do you grow? What are the right practices and habits to develop? Well, I mean, science suggests a bunch of options. It turns out that there are meditation practices like compassion meditation that people have been using for thousands of years, but now neuroscientists have demonstrated not only do those practices make us better, more effective empathizers, they actually change our brain in the process, even sort of growing parts of our brain that are associated with empathy. Another sort of tool that's available to all of us is our imaginations. Right. So it turns out that reading fiction or attending theater, right, not only allows us to imagine fictional people and connect with them, it actually opens and broadens our empathy for people who are different from ourselves in all sorts of ways. Mm. And then another thing that we can do is to try to connect with real people, not just fictional ones, right? I mean,
or not just people online.
Yes,
behind screens.
Yeah, I think that's
what do you think about all of that social media and especially young people? I'm going to sound like the old curmudgeon, but what is? Did you study at all? Kind of being stuck to devices and communicating virtually. You know what? How to create empathy when you are not, you know, meeting people in person a lot. You're not talking to people on the phone a lot. Your communication with people, a lot of it is, you know, on a screen and you're typing.
It's true. And, you know, I mean, the way I think of it is that the internet and social media in particular are humanity's greatest empathic opportunity that we've ever had. I know it doesn't sound that way, it doesn't seem that way now, but I mean, think of it. We can connect with anybody, anywhere, anytime on their own terms and respond with empathy. And if you read like Wired from 2010 or something, people were over the moon with the global community we were all gonna create. And now that just seems laughable, right? Mm. What went wrong? You know, I think that part of it is the way that social media platforms are constructed, which is not to keep users happy or connected, but just to keep them online by whatever means necessary. Mm. To, you know, so that they'll click on ads and so forth. And I think oftentimes what that means is that those platforms are best suited to our weaknesses, our frailties, right? Vanity, anger, fear, intolerance, and difference. And so sometimes, you know, so when I look at Twitter, for instance, what do I see? Well, I see that we don't have access to cues about people that might spark empathy. We can't see their faces. We can't hear their voices. We can't hear their stories. All we have are these quick, just strips of text. What do we have? Well, we have a system where we are rewarded with likes and retweets. And it turns out that research has demonstrated we're most rewarded when we express outrage towards people who are different from ourselves. And who rewards us? The people who already agree with us. Huh. So basically, we are in this ecosystem where we are seeing less of each other and being rewarded for doing things that dehumanize and sort of express intolerance towards others. So basically, social media could have been a great sort of source of empathy, and instead it gets in the way. I don't think that it will always, I don't think that it necessarily gets in the way. And I think that there are ways that we can change our online interactions to make them more empathy positive. But we haven't done that yet.
Jamil Zaki, thank you very much.
Thank you.